Welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is John Harris, author of Tomlin, The Soul of a Football Coach. John Harris is a veteran journalist who has covered sports, culture, race, and the executive search industry for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, Philadelphia Inquirer, Tampa Bay Times, ESPN's Anscape, CBS Sportsline, and others. And he resides here in Austin, Texas. And John, welcome to Diverse Voices Book Review.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
So for those who aren't big NFL football fans, I do want to share with them that Mike Tomlin was the second African-American coach to win the Super Bowl as the coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers. And when he was hired as a coach more than 15 years ago, it was a shock that this young, outstanding, talented coach got hired for that position over two Pittsburgh Steelers assistants that the players were actually excited or were hoping will be hired. But I want to go back to the beginning because I don't want this just to be a football interview, but I want you to share with me, why do you think the story, the life story of Mike Tomlin is important, not just to us NFL football fans, but to the community in general?
Well, and I hope, and I think it's an inspirational story. If you know his career path, one of the things that intrigued me about even doing the book, I was in Pittsburgh. One of the big reasons why I wrote the book, I covered the Steelers during that time when Mike Tomlin was hired and for several years afterwards. And so I'm, I guess, closer than most people in the industry, journalists, writers, to that, watching it happen right in front of my eyes. And but the thing about Mike Tomlin that was intriguing was that it was so little that we actually knew about him, other than being a coach, looking at him on the sidelines, listening to him at his press conferences, and that was the extent of it. So for me, it was trying to delve beneath that and who is this man? Look at his past. How did he get to where he's now in his 17th season with one NFL team, which is amazing. And I was intrigued initially just by his start as a college coach, which is where he laid the foundation. And I think it'd be good for readers to know. I mean, he didn't just, even though it seemed like he popped out of thin air and when he got the Steelers job at age 34, he climbed the ladder to get there, coaching at small colleges, small out-of-the-way colleges, you know, colleges that people didn't know anything about, where he really learned how to be a coach. And that's the part that I really tried to put into the book to let people to understand that even though he got the job at 34, he was well prepared for it. He had spent a lot of years grooming and developing and teaching and going through all types of situations to where when he got the Steelers job, it wasn't too big for him.
I want to talk about him growing up in Newport News, Virginia. And one of the things you point out early in the book was that he was not just a good football player. He played wide receiver for his high school and ended up playing for William and Mary College. He was also a star academic. Yeah. And so talk a little bit about this desire not to just succeed on the football field while he was in high school, but his ability to succeed in the classroom.
Well, it's funny because he's kind of like the typical egghead jock, really smart. He didn't want anybody to know about it. You know, he wanted to be cool, which, you know, when you're in high school, you don't want to be known as the egghead. You want to be known as the jock. So he talked about his mom would always put the word out on what a great student he was. But yeah, he was an excellent student. I mean, if you listen to his press conferences, the phrasing, the words he uses, you know, football coaches don't talk like that. And in fact, his mother wanted him to go to law school, be an attorney, and was disappointed when he didn't follow that career path. But yeah, very sharp, very smart. William and Mary is recognized as one of the top, you know, academic colleges in America. And for him to go there, he had offers, possibly go to some of the service academies, I think some Ivy League schools as well. But William and Mary was perfect for him. It was about 20, 25 minutes away from Newport News. So it's close to family, and he's very big on family. He and his brother, Ed, you know, their mother remarried. So the closeness to family was very, very important to them, something that he stresses a lot. And one of the things in the offseason, Mike Tomlin spends a lot of time doing programs for kids, for teens, for dads. That's a really big part. It's always been a big part of his life because you know, growing up for, you know, for years, you know, after his parents separated, it's always been a very important part of his life.
So Mike Tomlin was able to balance out being well-liked and known and hanging out with the fellas and excelling in the classroom at the same time. And you do point out that at William Mary, they expected you to go to class. I won't talk about other universities or other colleges, but William Mary, they expected you to go to class and to work both sides of it. And I know I had a nephew that played football for the University of Akron. And he talked about how difficult it was to excel academically and on the football field at the same time. But you bring up, I believe one of his fellow wide receivers talked about how he liked to read the newspaper, but didn't want anyone to know that he was reading so much to keep up with what was going on.
Yeah, it was just very, and the funny thing about it, he was two different people, which I bring out in the book. You know, the guy that read the morning paper, you know, the guy that was smart enough to go to William and Mary. But on the football field, the stories about him, you know, some of the players that we hear about now that he coaches, he was that guy, trash talker to his teammates, to coaches, to opponents. He and his teammates in the locker room strutting around after practice, going over to the DBs who they just burnt on passes. And ironically, one of those guys is the Buffalo Bills coach, Sean McDermott, was one of his teammates at William & Mary. And that was one of the guys he used to abuse as a wide receiver. So it's an interesting, when you look at him, he connects with the players that he coaches now because he was once a player. But he also has that intellectual side to him, which I think really separates him a lot from a lot of the coaches that we see out there. There's two sides to him. He's just not a football coach, but he's also a young black man from Newport News, Virginia, who grew up maybe in his brother, Ed talks a lot about every day they used to walk past a swimming pool that they couldn't use, that was segregated. So those lasting memories have always been in their mind. You know, growing up and still staying with them today, that, you know, the world that they succeeded in, you know, hasn't always been the most fair to the people that look like him. He's very aware of that. He just doesn't talk a lot about that. I know some people maybe want him to talk more about race and coaches in the NFL and in general. It's just something he's chose to maybe keep more close to the vest for his own personal reasons.
It's clear from the book that he's a leader of men. And I think this book is very instructive about how to develop character and learn how to lead men that are part of your team, that are part of organization, that are from very different backgrounds. And that seems to be one of the things in the book you talk about. His strength was he was very comfortable across cultural lines, across racial lines. He was a very inclusive leader as the captain of the William & Mary football team.
Yeah, his brother brought up a really good point. And he pointed to the fact when they were young, when they played, they all played sports, and they played in a group of kids, you know, black kids, white kids, kids from different backgrounds. And his brother attributes that to that carrying over when Mike was at William and Mary. He was a leader because he connected with everybody. He connected with people that looked like him. He connected with people that didn't look like him. He didn't really differentiate. His guy, you're on his team, you're his teammate. He was going to connect with you some way, somehow. I tell a fascinating story of he was a senior at William & Mary. Dan Quinn, who NFL fans may know now as the Dallas Cowboys defensive coordinator, he was the Atlanta Falcons head coach for a while. He was the first year defensive line coach. And one day this senior football player comes up to him and invites him to a fraternity party. Now, if you can imagine that, a football player in college going to a coach and inviting him to a party, just think about that dynamic for a minute. You know, Dan Quinn was white, a little bit older than him. So he had Mike had no barriers as far as race. I mean, you look at a lot of his former players, guys that play with him now, TJ Watt, his defensive end who leads the NFL in sacks. He doesn't want to play for anybody but Mike Tomlin. TJ Watt is white. A lot of his players, regardless of their backgrounds, racial, religious, whatever, they just love Mike Tomlin because he's a guy that connects with everybody.
It was very interesting to learn about William and Mary. So I learned that Marv Levy and Lou Holtz were head coaches at William & Mary College. Yeah. And I was like, William & Mary? And then when you look at the coaches that were at William & Mary in some shape, form, or fashion, whether as a player or as a coach, besides Tomlin, like you said, Sean McDermott, Brian Daboll. What is it about this William & Mary, this small, second oldest college in the country behind Harvard, second oldest in the country, producing all these football coaches?
That's a good question. The coach, Jimmy Laycock, talked about it a little bit. Basically, you know, first off, we know we're dealing with smart kids. So we treat them as such, and we make demands on them academically. But from a football strategic standpoint, Jimmy Laycock really...
Now, he was a William & Mary coach, head coach for many, many years.
Yeah, he challenged his players. I want you to know your plays. That's, you got to know your plays, right? You got to know the playbook. But we're going to go beyond that. We want to, you know, we want to understand your role in it and how your role fits you, how it fits the overall team. And I want you to be able to explain. I don't want you to just know that I run a, you know, a nine route. I want you to know why you run it, you know, what are the background, the particulars to it. I want you to be able to explain it, you know, to me, to your teammates, and for you to understand it. And I think that's carried over to some of these guys that have been able to coach at the NFL level, that, and just a total absorption of the playbook, understanding it, how to communicate it, I think is really good. You know, a lot of coaches are really smart, X and O's. They can tell you, you know, hey, you guys, you, but some of them don't know how to explain it. How do you explain it? How do you make it clear to your players? This is what I want you to do, and this is why I want you to do it. And then I want you to tell me back why we're doing it. What do you understand about this? Why are we doing this? So I think it's a very deep, the school is so small. It's just amazing. If you think of that many coaches in the NFL from William & Mary, it can't be a coincidence, right?
So there was a coach, William Bernard Ripshire, who was a William & Mary University, a William & Mary graduate. And he told Tomlin, when Tomlin was seeking a job as a coach, despite his mother's desire for him to do something else, that if he came to Memphis, coached at Memphis University, he would be in the NFL before he was 35. And he saw him at the American Football Coaches Association convention, which Tomlin went to find a job. And he became a mentor to Tomlin, who Tomlin discussed every career move with him. What was it that Shearer saw in Tomlin that had him accurately predicting the future about Tomlin?
What everybody tells me is it's his presence. He exudes confidence, his speaking voice, very direct. He looks at you when he communicates. But I think it's when coaches, they talk to so many different people. And some people, you know, they kind of fit a pattern. Tomlin just didn't fit that pattern. He stood out. I think it's just his presence, the confident. Even if he, it's like there's a line in the, describe it when he goes to Tampa. Someone I knew in Tampa told me, but the best way to describe Mike Tomlin is he's a brother on a team with brothers, but he's different because he's not really a brother because, you know, he went to William & Mary. So he can talk brother talk, but he can also communicate with everybody. He's able to walk that fine line. He's able to relate. He's able to communicate. So that way he's able to connect with a lot of people. A lot of people can't do that. They're comfortable with one group or that group. He's just comfortable with people in general. And I think Ripshear saw that in him. He was so young. He just graduated from William & Mary. And remember, there's this amazing connection. You brought it up. Ripshear, all these mentors to him, they all had some connection to William & Mary at one time or another. Even if Mike Tomlin, maybe he knew it. Maybe he was this brilliant guy that had done his homework and knew that all these guys had a William & Mary background. It wouldn't surprise me if he did know that. But that had something to do with it. There's so many of these coaches. His coach had a, you know, William & Mary. Ripshear, William & Mary. It was amazing the number of coaches that had a William & Mary background. his VMI coach, Bill Stewart, his first actual coach, had a William & Mary background. So I think one thing these people do through the industry, they know each other, whether it's former players, teammates, coaches. So there's this network. So they're going to tend to talk to someone, hey, what do you know about this guy, Mike Tomlin? You know, Rip Shearer coached against him when Rip Shearer was at James Madison. And Mike Tomlin was at William & Mary. So there's a lot of it goes back to just a historical perspective. They knew of him. And, hey, who was that guy? Who was that wide receiver at William & Mary? What can you tell me about him? So I think a lot of that came into play as well.
I think there's a lot of lessons from reading this book, just hearing you talk about his career path. And these are lessons that go far beyond football. Relationship building.
Yes.
Knowing the playbook, knowing the job, understanding your role, being comfortable working with people across different cultural groups. These are skill sets that are go far beyond football.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's a I'm going to be doing a couple of panels in January. And one of the topics is you just touched on it. This is a career path I think more kids should follow. Everybody wants to play in the NFL. Everybody wants to play in the NBA. But the numbers show that it's not going to happen. And even if you do make it, the average career life of an NFL player is like 2-3 years. That's it. The average. We're not talking about the superstars. We're talking about just the average guy that goes into the league. Mike Tomlin's career path, Mike Tomlin says in the book, he wanted to be an NFL player. He wasn't good enough. He failed. He talks about it. He calls it a failure. And it's always driven him. Motivated him, you know, as a coach, he's still connected to the game, but in a different way. I think more kids that are in college that are thinking about going to college should think about that. Don't just be, maybe you don't make it. Maybe you realize you're not good enough to go to the NFL, but don't give up on your career. You can get a good, have a good GPA, become a graduate assistant like Mike Tomlin did, get onto the coaching career path and, you know, climb your way up. And a lot of guys, they play and they keep trying out. They don't make it. They're 25, 26, 27. They say, oh, I want to be a coach. Well, by the time Mike Tomlin was 27, he was getting ready to get a job with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers because he had been coaching for about 5 years already. So sometimes maybe you should think more about, okay, sports got me to this point. It got me a college scholarship. I was able to do these things. But now let me coach. Mike Tomlin has made a lot more money than most of his players. Probably close to $50 million as a coach. And he's able to walk around and play with his kids. He's not walking, limping with a limp. He played college ball and he moved on. And I think more kids, and I think more African-American kids should think about their career path. Becoming coaches is a lot of hard work. He made $8,000 one year at a VMI. Sacrifice. If it's a passion that you have, you know football, you've been doing it your whole life. Think about it from a career, from a coaching standpoint, from an athletic director standpoint, you know, from an athletic administrator standpoint. There's a lot of opportunities out there for people that have sports backgrounds. And I think you can get some of that message out of this book.
Let's jump to him becoming the coach of the Pittsburgh Steelers, because what you have is a storied franchise. What you have is him succeeding ultimately a Hall of Fame football coach who had won the Super Bowl a couple of years before. What you have is a young man taking over a veteran team, knowing that he was not the team, the player's first choice or second choice to become coach. What was his secret to winning over the players?
I think a lot of it had helped him in Tampa Bay. And that was the thing that the reporters in Pittsburgh, when I was there, everybody was shocked that they hired him. He's 34, blah, blah, blah. But I think we didn't know the past. And I think the Tampa Bay experience really prepared him, because he took over. He was a secondary coach. So John Lynch, who was a Hall of Famer, Rondé Barber, who just went to the Hall of Fame. John Lynch was older than Mike Tomlin when Mike Tomlin took the job. So there was skepticism from the players. Who was this guy? He wasn't even 30 years old then. And he won them over, not with words, but by coming to them with cut-ups of their tapes from the previous year. Hey, I did 63 cut-ups of you, John Lynch, of certain plays. You know, this is what you did good. This is what you did bad. This can make you better. You know, and John Lynch, he was older than Mike Tomlin, is like flabbergasted. This guy actually took this time. And NFL players, you know, age or not, they see you know what you're doing and you can make them better, they respect that. So I think he took that mindset to Pittsburgh, you know, which had won a Super Bowl, confident guys, wanted another coach. He was going to win them over being Mike Tomlin, going to Ryan Clark and breaking down his tape and telling him, look, you've been a journeyman your whole life. We're going to make you a Pro Bowl player, which he did. Ike Taylor, a cornerback who had been benched by Bill Cowher. You know, we're going to put you back, get you doing what you're comfortable with. So he showed players what, you know, how to get better. You know, he didn't brag or I'm going to do this. He did it by hard work. He won them over by showing them that he can make them a better team than what they were, even though they had won a Super Bowl, even though they wanted Russ Grimm or Ken Whisenhunt. You know, even though Ben Roethlisberger, the quarterback, took him to lunch and said, you're going to have to earn the trust of his players. Think about that. 34-year-old coach and the quarterback tells you that. You know, I don't think any coach could have gone in there and done that. You had to be strong mentally and you have to be supremely confident, you know, in what you can do.
So how strong mentally and supremely confident were you when you decided to write this book, knowing that Mike Tomlin was not going to give you an interview? So we're going to have to put together a number of other sources, including Ed Tomlin, his brother, and others, because I can understand why Mike Tomlin doesn't want to do a lot of interviews, because these days with social media, whatever you say can be taken out of context.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was a challenge, Hopton. I'll tell you, it was my editor, Jason Katzman. I really credit him a lot. He encouraged me to do this project. And I studied biographies in general. I know there was a biography a year or so ago about Bo Jackson. And I talked to the author a little bit, and Bo Jackson didn't talk to him. So you have to have a belief in, you know, what you can do as a writer and the information that you can, you know, that you can accumulate and acquire. And I just believe that I was the best person to tell this story because I was there. You know, you could have brought in a Peter King or someone like that, you know, a national guy, but he wasn't there. I was there. I was there every day. I was at training camps. I observed it. I watched him. I was in press conferences. I saw him win a Super Bowl. I saw the media in Pittsburgh, you know, take him apart like a taking the wings off of a fly. I saw him in all those different ways. I listened to the talk shows. You know, the fans of Pittsburgh did not want Mike Tomlin. And if you look at it today, they still don't want him. You know, and now the information is growing stronger and stronger against him. So I was there and I figured, I can do this book. He deserves this book. It was shocked me that he didn't have a book written about him after all these years. I knew for sure that someone had written a book about Mike Tomlin. So I think it was all those things. But like, you know yourself as a writer, you got to believe in yourself and what you're capable of doing. I just believed that I could do a really good job with this and that I could tell a story that about a guy that a lot of people think they know, but really don't.
So how difficult was you to think back? Because I believe you started writing for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review in 2007, was it?
Yeah,
2007. So how difficult is it to go back that far? Of course, you pull from your files, you got all the old articles, but to think about what angle you were trying to achieve or what you were trying to achieve with the articles and the things that were going on with Mike Tomlin back then, how difficult was that?
It was a challenge. Going back, it was funny. I used some of my articles in the book, and I had forgotten about some of them. I was like, wow, I wrote this, you know, and it started bringing back memories, just researching, talking to people, you know, people that I knew back then, you know, reporters, players. It started bringing a lot of it back. That I devoted like a whole chapter to that whole process, the newspaper war in Pittsburgh, and that coaching search. I don't know if there'll ever be another coaching search like that ever again. It was mysterious. It was cloak and dagger. It was everything. And I felt like it was important to bring that out for people to see. They didn't just hire him one day. It was an incredible process that, you know, it came out the day that before he was hired that Sports Illustrated had written an article that he got the job. And then my newspaper erroneously wrote that Russ Grimm got the job. You know, people were saying, well, Mike Tomlin got the job because he's black. And it's called the Rooney Rule after Steelers chairman Dan Rooney. And they felt pressure. So that's why they hired him. So he stepped into all, you know, he got hired because he was black. So think about the pressure. And then the second year, when they go to the Super Bowl and win it, he's coaching against Ken Wisenhunt and Russ Grimmer on that staff in Arizona. And as John Wooten said, who had a lot to do with Mike Tomlin getting the job, what if he had lost that game? All the people in Pittsburgh who had wanted Ken Wisenhunt or Russ Grimm, it would have given them so much ammunition to say, why did we hire this guy when we could have had the guy that beat him in the Super Bowl? So it was so many, there were so many things at play in this that he had to overcome really quickly, which I think is part of his legend, his legacy, what he was able to come in and do right away, establish a new frontier for black NFL coaches. I think that he's going to go down in history. He'll go to the Hall of Fame one day. He'll be remembered a lot more fondly, I think, when he's no longer coaching than what's going on in Pittsburgh right now. They're struggling. They're at 7-7 and may or may not make the playoffs. He's in danger of his first losing season. So it's really fascinating to see how he's handling these, you know, the end of this season and how it turns out.
I'm going to have to ask you this because it was brought up at your appearance at Black Pearl Books here in Austin, Texas, by the Cleveland Browns, the former NFL football player that was on the panel in the discussion with the owner. So when the catch that was made by the NFL Pittsburgh Steelers wide receiver, was he in bounds?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it was a great catch. It was a great
catch. That's what Levi said.
No. Great catch. He had tiptoes down. Unbelievable. Now, it could never be done. You could never do that. You could never duplicate that play. It was incredible. I mean, the catch and the previous play, he had dropped a pass on the other side of the end zone. And he had a pass that went right through his hands. So Ben Roethlisberger goes back to him the next play. And there were three defensive backs around there. So I don't think Ben Roethlisberger ever threw a better pass because there were three defensive backs right there. I figured somebody was going to intercept it. He caught it. Santonio Holmes caught it. I looked at the replays. Yeah, I understand, Levi. I know. He'll take that forever. He'll say
that. For our audience, Levi played for the Arizona Cardinals, and he was, of course, at the Black Pro Book. So he was on that team. Shouldn't he have had a discussion with Kurt about throwing that interception at the goal line?
I thought that was the game. I thought that was the game. I thought Arizona had taken the momentum. They were like the 2 or 3 yard line. It was right before halftime. And Kurt Warner throws an interception, and James Harrison runs it back 100 yards, which I argue was the greatest play ever in Super Bowl history. And if someone had just – you could have tackled him 1 yard short of the end zone, and he wouldn't have scored because it was the last play of the half. And the Cardinals would have, despite the interception, would have gone into halftime with a lead. They would have had the momentum. They had to open – they took the second half kickoff. They would have gotten it. I argue that was where the game was won, that – play right there. But that was a game of incredible plays like that. Larry Fitzgerald had an unbelievable touchdown catch late, the Santonio Holmes touchdown catch, and just what we were talking about before, Mike Tomlin versus Ken Wisenhunt, and that dynamic, which was there, even if people weren't talking about it, it was in everyone's mind.
That's storytelling. When you look at these games, that's sort of like, what is the story? And I want you to talk about your journey from journalists to book writer, because you co-authored the autobiography of Edgerrin, the memoir of Edgerrin James. And then, of course, you wrote this book independently. How difficult is it? I mean, on the outside, for those who don't write regularly, say, oh, you're a journalist, you're already writing articles. So, you know, writing a book isn't a big deal. But is it a difficult transition to go from writing articles to writing a book? And how do you prepare yourself and work through that?
I think it's a mental challenge, to be honest with you. I mean, I was a sports writer for almost 40 years, you know, working different newspapers around the country. And it's easier in the sense that you have an assignment, you have a beat, you know, you have your stories, you know what your responsibility is, you do it. As an author, first off, I was a sports columnist as well. So a sports columnist is kind of out on the island because you write your opinions and people react, good or bad. So as an author, you're definitely out on the island. You're by yourself. Not everybody's going to love what you do. You know, you hope enough people do. And you just learn to really trust in yourself. And to me, becoming an author, like, has empowered me more as a writer. because when I was working for a newspaper, and I work for a lot of them, you're writing for someone else in a sense, right? And yeah, for the book, with the book you're doing, you're writing, you have a publisher, but you're writing, it's you. You're doing it on your own. Sitting up at night, 3 o'clock in the morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, writing, okay, I got to finish this chapter. How do I do it? So I think it's good. I think you dig deep down. You find out more about yourself. I know I have. You know, I wrote that book. I can't believe I wrote that book. Is 120,000 words. I wrote it literally in a year. And I never thought I could do that. But you know, you never know until you do it, right? And I did it. We wanted to get the book out for this season. And if I didn't get it done by a particular date, it wasn't going to come out.
Wow.
So I had to shut everything down, you know, and just do it. And like you say, yeah, as a writer, you know, people don't really understand in a sense. You know, what are you doing up there? You're writing. Okay. Oh, you're writing. Okay, big deal. But, you know, you're feeling pressure because people are watching. You know, when's the book coming out? Is it coming out? It's not coming out. And are they going to like it? What are they going to think? What's Mike Tomlin going to think? You know, I'm so thankful to Ed Tomlin, who was great. And through Ed Tomlin, I realized that Mike Tomlin had no problem rewriting the book because they're close. They're the only two siblings. If he didn't want the book done or if he didn't want his brother wouldn't have participated. I mean, he basically told me that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for bringing it up, because a lot of people participate who I would assume would not if Mike Tomlin didn't want to do it. Let me ask you this. Tony Dungy wrote the foreword. Tony Dungy, he worked for Tony Dungy at Tampa Bay. Yeah. Tony Dungy was the first African-American to win the Super Bowl, Hall of Fame coach. What did you learn from talking to Tony Dungy about Mike Tomlin?
Tony Dungy is a really interesting individual. He's very quiet, very laid back. But to me, a fire burns within him. You look at what he did. He to me is the guy. You look at the coaches who he hired and empowered. Mike Tomlin became a head coach. He hired Herm Edwards, became a head coach. Lovie Smith became a head coach. Jim Caldwell, when he was in Indianapolis, became a head coach. He was very intentional with those hires. When he hired a coach, it was a black coach, he put him in positions that normally maybe coaches, assistants aren't in, you know. Okay, you come in this meeting, you come into this meeting. We're going to let you see the whole gamut. This is what it means to be a head coach. These are the things that you're going to have to do when you're deciding who's your quarterback going to be. Okay, come into this meeting so you can see the steps that we have to follow. Talking to the media. A lot of coaches don't really want their assistants to talk to the media. Tony Dungy, you know, wants one of his coaches to talk to the media because that's a part of being a head coach. The media is very important in that regard. You got to deal with the media, right, every day. It's a big thing. Some coaches aren't comfortable with it, and it hurts them if they're not able to build that base of support, you know, from the press. Mike Tomlin was this young coach who just was recommended to him, and he said within 5 minutes of the interview, he didn't really know Mike Tomlin. One of his coaches recommended him. Again, this assistant coach had a contact with the University of Cincinnati coach where Mike Tomlin was. They went back like 20 years. So he calls this guy that he's known for 20 years and asks him about Mike Tomlin. He says, hey, if you meet this guy, you're going to want to hire. And Coach Dungy trusted his coaches. They brought him in for an interview. And he said, I knew I was going to hire him. Tony Dungy liked intelligent coaches, coaches that could teach their players, that understood the game, that carried themselves professionally. Mike Tomlin fit that very well. But Mike Tomlin took it to another level. His confidence, his ability to hold a room, as they say, he takes a room in and just, it's like a, you know, like a really well-spoken politician. People are paying attention, they're listening to it. He gets them in. And not only do they listen to him, but they're getting his message. They understand what he's saying. And he's putting it on a level that, you know, makes them want to challenge themselves to get better. So all these qualities some of the qualities that Tony Dungy had in himself, he saw in Mike Tomlin.
How much is being a head coach as much about management as it is about X's and O's? Because you're running a very large organization. It's not just being on the practice field with X's and O's.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge, I mean, they say it many times, an NFL coach is more like a CEO. And it's really important that you hire the right coordinators and the right assistant coaches, because you're trusting them. Like, you can't coach, I mean, you're coaching the whole team, but you can't be everywhere, right? You can't coach the quarterback and the defensive back and the running back. You got to trust the people that you hire to do that. Now, of course, you have a final say. Okay, do we go for it on fourth down or do we punt? Yeah, you do those calls, but you've got to delegate, you know, but your message has to be in every one of those coaches' minds and ears. They're taking your message and putting their spin on it as they coach, but they're taking Coach Tomlin's message with them, with their position, you know, the players that they're coaching. And it takes time. I mean, you know, when Mike Tomlin got to Pittsburgh, you know, he was very difficult. He was a tough coach. They had real tough training camps. He felt like he had to prove a point as a young coach. But his second year, he backed off because the players said, you know, you're pushing us too hard, coach. We're going to give you what you want. And they won a Super Bowl second year. So he, as a young coach, he learned, you know, you don't have to just do that. Listen to your players, trust them, you know, and look at how they perform. So it is a balancing act between I'm in charge and then trusting other people, you know, to coach your players.
I want to close with going back to advice you would give to the parents of high school football players, because as we know here in Texas, football, high school football is huge. And as we know, you have everybody wants to go pro. Most want to go to pro, but only 1% will actually end up going pro. But I want you to talk about what can players get out of playing football? Because I tend to see from the outside, I didn't play organized sports in high school, that the learning how to lead, learning how to work with the group, but how can they position themselves so that even if they don't play college ball, pro ball, that what they learn from that experience of playing high school football helps them the rest of their life?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, even if they don't continue in sports, you know, whether they get into business, education, those qualities, you know, the teamwork, you know, learning how to work together, learning how to work with people that are, you know, football brings people from all different backgrounds, all different races. Your locker room is, what they say, is probably the most integrated place in America. You've got all these guys, you know, some of them, you know, one guy's listening to country music, you know, one guy's listening to gangster rap, you know, but then they got to get on the offensive line together and block and do it as a team. And you see the emotion when you watch a football game. Look at how the guys interact sometime on the sideline. You know, white guys with black guys with white guys, and you see how they interact. We don't necessarily see it like that in the real America, the way it is. So I think that's a lesson that sports can teach, is that you're in this world, and this is the world right here, right? This is what you're going to be encountering. You're going to be encountering people from all walks of life, regardless of what it is that you do, what you end up doing. And you, if you really want to succeed in this world, you're going to have to understand how to navigate some of that and how to make it work. You mentioned earlier, context. Contacts are just so important in sports. You know, people remember you. Hey, you were the star running back for the local high school. You know, maybe it's an attorney. Maybe it's a business guy. You know, we also have to learn how do we use those contacts? It's great to run for 1,000 yards at the old Alma Mater high school, but maybe that can translate to something else as you grow older. Start thinking more along those lines. Parents, start thinking more along those lines. Just don't always think about my baby playing in the NFL. Like you mentioned, the odds of that happening are just incalculable against it happening. It can happen, but there's a lot of other things that you can do with sports, whether it's in sports, or whether it's in any other walk of life. So I think that's a big lesson to be taken from that. Sports builds character, as they say. It sounds like a cliche, but it does. And they really learn, people really learn how to interact with those that maybe they're not comfortable with. And I think that's really important.
Okay, I lied when I said that was the last question. I have one more I got to ask, because we have so many former athletes with podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
But I will tell you that I have been so impressed, because I think there's a stereotype of talented athletes, especially talented Black athletes, that it's just talent. But every podcast, whether it's Shannon Sharp or Gilbert Arenas or RC, Ryan Clark, The Pivot, what I've learned two things I've learned, which have been great lessons for me. Number one, these athletes worked very, very hard to succeed. It wasn't just talent. They worked incredibly hard to be successful. Or J.J. Redick, incredibly hard to be successful. That's the one lesson. Number two, what I've learned is they respect talent regardless of race.
Yeah.
They respect game regardless of race.
Yep. Well, they see it. They live it. The stereotypes don't mean anything to them because they're living it. They see it. What I write, what the media writes from the outside is nothing. Because to be honest with you, we don't know what's going on in the locker room. You know, we don't really know what people are saying. We know what some source told us, and then we report that. But what's actually going on, like you said, the actual respect that takes place between teammates, you know, that's a whole nother level that we don't know or understand. And only an athlete or someone in that position can understand. So, yeah, I think if we could translate that, sports is the great equalizer. Black quarterbacks. I mean, at the end of the day, there was a time when there were no black quarterbacks. But guess what? At the end of the day, these teams want to win, right? So they're going to play who they think is going to give them the best chance to win. It doesn't matter who they are. So it means I'm going to draft this guy in the first round, first pick in the draft, and he's black, so be it. What other walk of life can we say that about? Well, that happens on a pretty regular basis now.
Now, finally, it's happening because, you know, in the past, there was the stereotyping of black quarterbacks and they're athletic and they want them to be athletic, or because they're athletic that they really can't pass. And, of course, we've sort of seen the change of this, but I just thought it was interesting from a player-to-player perspective. And actually, most of the podcasts I'm listening to are mostly basketball players, except for The Pivot. And just this, they just talk about talent and respect, and even listening to Levi at the Black Pearls bookstore, Black bookstore here in Austin, Texas. Players respect people who know the game and understand the game, and that's really what's most important to them.
Yeah, especially at the professional level, because if I see you as a coach and you can help me get better, that means I can make more money, right? I can get better as a player. I can improve. I can get more money. I can provide for my family better. And that's what at the pro level, that's what it comes down to, you know, getting better, maximizing yourself, you know, professionally, athletically, as well as financially. So respect, you know, like you said, game respects game.
John Harris, author Tomlin, The Soul of a Football Coach, thank you so much for being a guest on Diverse Voices Book Review.
Hope, I really appreciate it. I had a blast, man.
Thank you for listening to Diverse Voices Book Review. I'm Hopeton Hay, host and producer. The theme music is provided by Wright Productions. You can follow the show on social media. Under Facebook and Instagram, it's Diverse Voices Book Review, or Twitter under @DiverseBooksHay.